I want to ask you a serious question. Do you feel a little stuck in your two-person scenes? Do you feel like you're doing the same scenes over and over again, like every scene you do is about a roommate? Well, if you answer yes, then I want to help. And the best way I know how to help you is by letting you know that I will be teaching my two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop on Saturday, December 30th, here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people, so you get personal attention. To register or for more information, just go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're a seasoned improviser, an actor, or new to improv, I just want to let you know I'll be starting my next Artist Low Comedy Level 1 class on January 10th at Green Shirt Studios here in Chicago. I also limit this to 10 people, so you get personal attention. And to register or for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com.
Feral Audio.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Sam Wasson. He is the author of his new book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. And I really wanted to get an episode out to you during the holidays because I know how the holidays can be. And you may be driving across country back to your parents' house, and you may be in the car and you may be saying, you know what, I really wish Jimmy would put out a new episode of Improv Nerd because I've listened to all of them. So here's that episode. Or you may be at home for 4 days with your parents already, and they're driving you crazy, and you're like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And you may want to sneak up to your old room, the room that you grew up in, and download a new episode of Improv Nerd, and this is it. So I hope just hearing my voice leads a little comfort during the holidays, because I don't know about you, the holidays, there's a lot of emotion in the holidays. There's a lot of stress in the holidays. So I hear you. So I hope you enjoy this episode. And I just wanted to make sure I got it out to you. So our guest today is Sam Wasson. He has written this wonderful book, Improv Nation, which I'm actually quoted in a couple times. That's just I hope that's not a spoiler alert. I kind of wanted to think it'd be cool to surprise you, but also it may entice you to buy the book. We cover a lot of history of improv in this episode. We talk a little about Viola Spolin, Into the Compass Players, Second City, Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray, SCTV, The Herald, and Del Close, and how he came up with that name. We talk about Chicago in the 80s and 90s and why that was such a special time. We talk a little about improv versus stand-up. There's something for everyone in this episode. I know you're going to enjoy it. Here it is, the Sam Wasson episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
How were you first introduced to improv?
I did it at college. I was in a group called Desperate Measures, which was at Wesleyan University, where I went to college. And it was short formy, gamey, whose line is it anyway type of stuff. And we didn't know what we were doing. We just enjoyed each other and just tried our best to be funny. It really wasn't a good idea. And I'm embarrassed of some of it, but one of the coolest things that we did, which I'm really proud of, is we did a 24-hour comedy show, which was, you know, had moments of absolute like disastrous mess, and then transcendent moments that were totally emotionally risky and exploratory. That stands out as a highlight. But yeah, it was college improv. It was just like fucking around.
But you've gone on to be a successful author. You've written a lot of books. Why did you want to write a book about improv?
Well, there were a lot of different reasons. One, I grew up idolizing the SCTV company. I mean, I loved SCTV. So, you know, that was like my earliest comedy orgasm. And you know, then life happens and I fell in love with the work of Paul Mazursky. Harold Ramis was a friend of my family's. I, like everyone else, was in love with Mike and Elaine. And slowly you begin to put this together of like, well, all of these giants came from this place. So it really wasn't improv per se that got me into improv. It was the work of the people that came out of it later. And then I did the math. I sort of solved for X, and that took me back to Compass.
And the Compass Players, tell us a little about, you know, so the Compass Players, Paul Sills, David Shepard, they form the Compass Players. And you mentioned Mike Nichols, Elaine May, Shelley Berman, and Dal Closer in that group. What is the significance of that group to the history of improv?
The first improvisational theater in America, and as far as I can tell, the world. You know, if you believe, as I do, that this stuff absolutely began with the work that Sills did from Viola's work, you know, if you believe this began in Chicago, then it is the first improvisational theater in the world.
And Viola, who was Paul Sills' mother, so if the Compass is in 1955 when they put it together, she's working on these games, these improv games in the 40s. How did she didn't develop these originally for performance, did she?
Right. No, it was Sills who tried to do this for performance for the first time. His mother, Viola, developed these games as sort of rehearsal tools for her group of young actors, originally at the Hull House in Chicago. She found that these children, she was a social worker and she did drama for children. And you know, like everyone else, she found that these children couldn't really relate to each other on stage, that they were self-conscious and locked up. And she developed the games as a way to break down the barriers between them. But she didn't consider the games themselves to be a presentational form. That was something that Sills did later, and that was the Compass.
And for improvisers who are listening to this podcast or actors who listen to this podcast, what would you tell them who've been doing this for a long time, either improvising or acting or doing sketch? Why is it important for them to know the history of improv?
I think because it opens up the possibilities of what you can do with this stuff. If you just know what your theater does. And every improvisational theater has its own philosophy, just like Dell had his own philosophy and Paul had his own philosophy and Mick has his own. If you know the history, then you know all of the colors in your all the brushes in your toolkit, to fuck up the metaphor. You know everything that you can do if you know everything that has been done.
And that will make you a better improviser, do you think?
Absolutely. And because improvisation is life, I'm a better person.
So you mentioned Dell, and Dell is part of the Compass Players. And I got to study with Dell in the 80s. He had a very strong personality. When he first started at the Compass back in the 50s, what was his view on improv?
It was pretty much like the Dell that you knew. He was interested in this rogue, incipient, messy form and figuring out how to push it in new directions. He enjoyed the infinite potential of it. He enjoyed pushing people's buttons, pushing the form's boundaries, figuring out what this monster of improvisation was. And that's basically how I understand the later Dell to be. He was always committed to exploring this art form. Well, and that started right away.
Well, which I found really interesting because he was already, I mean, I'd worked with him 30 years later, and his mission took, you know, 30, 40 years to achieve. He really wanted to make improv an art form.
Right. And that's what he and Elaine and a fellow named Ted Flicker were puzzling over there in the St. Louis Compass, I think in 1957 or 58, around then. They really wanted to sit down and say, okay, how do we take this free-for-all that's sometimes funny and sometimes not funny and organize it in a way that it can be an actually reliable presentational art form?
And you're talking about the kitchen table rule.
Yes.
Ted Flicker and Dell
I mean, it was like a little research, like a laboratory that when they were at the St. Louis Compass. And rules like don't deny, an agreement, make strong choices, all came out of that.
Right, right. Yes, that's the beginning of Yes And.
You know, and it's funny because you would have thought it would have was discovered in Chicago, but it was really discovered in St. Louis.
Yeah, yeah.
They should put a plaque there in St. Louis because that, I mean, to know that the rules came from St. Louis as an improviser, and that's one of the things I learned in your book.
Yeah, I didn't realize that that's sort of out of sync with Chicago, but of course you're right. I mean, we think of these guys as such Chicago guys that it is funny that in St. Louis is where this started to really flower.
And I wonder really if that was... that helped them because they were away from everything and they were almost like, you know, like on an island and they had no distractions. If that helped them come up with those rules.
1,000% yes. Because back in Chicago where they had their original compass, they were still living under the influence of David Shepard's and Paul Sills's vision of what improvisation was going to be. And it was only when they moved to St. Louis, away from Sills and Shepard, did they start to focus in on the more entertainment aspects of improvisation and the more improvisational comedic aspects of improvisation. That didn't really get going to St. Louis. So your point is absolutely right. Away from those guys, they had the freedom to reinvent the form, to define it in their own way.
And so that would make sense then going to 1950 when some of the Compass players start the new theater, Second City. And I get a sense from your book is there's almost like this schism. There's almost like this divide. Some of us want to do it for comedic and entertainment purposes, and some of us want to hold on to the art. And to read that in your book, that struggle that I certainly experienced in the 80s, it still goes on today, really was something going all the way back to when Second City started.
Yeah, it's one of the questions is that we all ask is what is improvisation? Is spot improvisation the only kind of improvisation? Does it still count? Do you still call it improvisation if you're revisiting if you're improvising an old scene? I mean, improvisation really is a spectrum, and different people in this book define it differently. Second City's definition of it, I think, was more conservative along the line of that spectrum. And whether or not you call that improvisation is a debate. Del obviously didn't feel that was improvisation, and that created a lot of difficulty between him and Bernie that would last their entire careers.
Right, because Bernie Salins and Del Close had the long, feuding, artistic argument, which was Bernie believed that improv was a tool to create sketch, and Del thought it could stand on its own and be in its own art form. And then in the 70s, at Second City, a guy named Bill Murray shows up. And what did you learn about Bill Murray in terms of being an improviser in those early days?
You know, I learned basically that if you were on Bill Murray's wavelength, if you followed the Bill Murray rules, which are not always known to you, in fact, most of the time they're not, but if you follow the Bill Murray code, you're in heaven improvisationally. And the shadow side to that is if you don't, then you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. And sometimes literally the shit kicked out of you. So it sort of problematizes our ideal of Bill Murray, the improviser, because he's not playing with everyone, Bill Murray. He's not an equal opportunity improviser. And if you come at him with a sort of cerebral approach, a high-minded approach, if he reads in you anything that smacks of high status or power, you're not going to be able to jam. That's what I learned.
When you were writing this book, I mean, Harold Ramis, of course, who had a Second City background and went on to direct a lot of classic comedies with Bill Murray, you know, including Groundhog Day and Stripes and Caddyshack. Why do you think those guys work so well together?
Why do they work so well together? I mean, you know, I think it's the same reason any two improvisers work so well together is because they have mutual respect. Bill Murray and Harold Ramis had mutual respect. And they also served the same functions that Nichols and May served, you know, which is Mike and Harold were the sort of editors to Elaine and Bill Murray's, you know, deep dives into improvisational unknowns. So they had the yin and the yang going for them as well. I think that was it. I don't think that they were a match made in heaven, Bill Murray and Harold. Like, I do think Mike and Elaine shared the same mind. You know, Bill Murray and Harold, I think one was an editor and one was an improviser. And they just had the good fortune, like so many of the people in this story, to be at the same place at the same time, which was Second City.
Did you, in your research for the book, because I'm a huge Bill Murray and Harold Ramis fan, did you get any clues about, you know, when they were filming Groundhog Day, Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, it was a very rough set, directing that movie. And then they didn't talk for a long time. Did you find anything in your research what the rift might have been about? I heard later in life they did make amends to each other, but did you find anything?
What I found out, and in my section on Groundhog Day, I cover this, and the idea is that, you know, I talked about Bill Murray being a guy that if you can play with him, you're in great shape, and if you can't, you can't, and that has to do with if he perceives you as high status, too high status. At that point, he decided that Harold was too high status, and he saw him behaving as a kind of king, which is not at all the case from what I understood from all of my research. But Murray saw Harold acting like the boss, and he got angry at that. Harold suddenly was no longer just a groundling like him. I mean, Shakespearean groundling, obviously.
Right.
And that was the source of a lot of hostility. And so Bill Murray proceeded to try to take Harold down, to cut him down to size. And this made no sense to anyone else on set. I spoke to, Trevor Albert, who was Harold's assistant and a producer on the film, got a tremendous testimony from Doc Erickson, who was associate producer, and other folks. And the across-the-board feeling was that nobody had any idea where this came from, but it was directed at Murray's perception of Harold's power.
And then in the 70s, Saturday Night Live, and you mentioned SCTV, which was a big influence for you, they premiere on television. How important is this to the future of improv at this point?
Right. How important is SCTV?
Yes, and Saturday Night Live.
Well, Saturday Night Live was really the moment where, I mean, Saturday Night Live cuts both ways, right? And as you know, and your listeners know, on the one hand, it forces people, an awareness of Saturday Night Live forces people into an awareness that they could fail. There is now a destination. I want to get this show. I want to get this money. I want this to happen in my career. Now that takes them out of the play mode that's necessary for improvisation and into a goal-oriented thinking that doesn't allow them to be free. So to that extent, Saturday Night Live can be destructive to improvisation. On the other hand, what Saturday Night Live did for Second City is it brought it to national awareness. And I don't want to, you know, and I'm sure one of the, maybe one of the reasons you got to improv was because growing up as a kid, you were seeing Saturday Night Live and going, hey, I wanted to do that. Was that the case for you?
I can tell you in the 80s when we started, the path was to get on main stage at Second City and then get to Saturday Night Live. It was a very, very narrow path. But I was exposed to Second City when I was in high school because I grew up in Chicago, and it was an institution here.
Well, the community around improvisation that grew up in the late 80s and the 90s, which was such a rich, fertile period for improvisation, and it's almost like the Renaissance in Italy, I don't think that could have happened if Saturday Night Live didn't exist, because Saturday Night Live was like the the summons to all of American improvisers to come to Chicago. And because of Saturday Night Live, it drew them all together to really create the explosion that happened. So, but what you're saying is that you were slightly before that.
Well, and I think to your point, too, in terms of, so when I started in the 80s, there was a lot of people who moved here to Chicago to do improv. Now, you got to remember, the 80s, there was no New York and no Los Angeles long form scene. But I think really Saturday Night Live, for a lot of those people that had moved here to Chicago, that gave them a goal, a bigger goal. But also they started to know more about Second City through Saturday Night Live and this guy named Del Close.
Right. And so even if their goal was Saturday Night Live and coming to Chicago, once they landed in Chicago and got to I.O., for the most part, it was I.O. at this period. Then they started to discover this thing that they didn't know virtually anything about. And that was the life of an improviser.
Right. Some of us are still living that life.
Yeah.
50s. So let's talk about the I.O. Because I was there in the 80s. And this was a little after my time. But this is where Del meets Sharna Halperin. And it's then called the Improv Olympic. And this is where Del fully realizes this thing that he's been working on for years called the Herald. What do you think made that possible?
I think it was a combination of Sharna, who, as has been told many times over, sort of brushed Del off and gave him a space to do what Del needed to do, which is what he couldn't do at Second City. So Sharna took care of him emotionally and gave him the theater that he needed to create his magic. That's one thing. The other thing is you. I mean, you and your friends. I mean, Del had the guinea pigs he needed. This rabidly hungry generation of let's go crazy improvisers, which is what you guys were. The first generation to really be interested deeply in not so much the showbiz of it, but the art of it. You were the perfect guinea pigs for Del. So the combination of those two things set the stage for the Herald to finally, after, you know, 20 years of being in Del's unconscious, to finally emerge.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, I came a little after, but I mean, to watch Baron Barracudas do, you know, a Herald, I mean, to me, that was the team that really, they really got it, you know, really got Del's work. How did he come up with that name?
The Herald, the names began in the committee when Del was working at the committee, the San Francisco Improv Group in the mid to late 60s. And there he was with Bill Mathieu, who was the former Second City pianist, and Alan Meyerson, who was a Second City improviser and director, who then founded the committee. These guys, unbeknownst to each other, were starting to experiment with long form. Del was just one of three guys who were doing this. And when they finally came together and it was sort of became apparent that they were all experimenting with the same thing, the question was asked, what are we going to call this? And I think it was Bill Mathieu who was sitting at the piano and said, why don't we call it the Herald? I think it was Bill Mathieu. And the name came as a kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference to Hard Day's Night, I think it was, where someone asked Paul what he was going to call his haircut. And he said, Arthur. and so it was a meaningless joke. It was meaningless. It was a pure meaningless literal improvisation in the moment. And the name stuck for better or for worse, probably for worse, because Harold, first of all, people think of Harold Ramis. And Harold Ramis didn't have anything to do with it. It has nothing to do with Harold. And also, the name itself is a joke, which undermines the real artistic ambition of what Del was trying to do. I wish there was a better name. I mean, what do you like the name?
You know, the thing is that it's like one of those things that it's been around for so long, it just takes on its own meaning.
So no one thinks of it as pejorative or. No. Okay.
No.
So that's good.
But so now you mentioned in the – so I started in the 80s, and then I'm around in the 90s. And you cover this in the in this book, and it just – I mean, I couldn't put your book down, and especially when you get to this part because I'm in it. Thank you for quoting me several times. But you mentioned that it is this Renaissance period. But when I look back at it, it's happening outside the institutions because at this point, Second City is kind of like it's the same old, and now groups like Ed and Jazz Freddy, which I was lucky to be a part of, and then a startup theater, which I was a part of as well, called the Annoyance Theater. And then we see the early formation of the Upright Citizens Brigade. And it's not the original four, but it's a bigger a group of people with like Horatio Sands and Adam McKay. What kind of impact does this kind of almost an independent scene have on the institutions in Chicago at that time?
They yes and it, you know? I mean, Second City under Kelly Leonard and mostly Kelly. Kelly saw Jazz Freddy. I think I'm remembering this accurately. Kelly saw Jazz Freddy and he said, hey, wait a second. They're doing what we should be doing. We're stuck in the past. So he yes-anded it. And they even yes-anded Dell in 1989 and invited Dell back. And that was a show he did with Farley. So finally, because of all these independent influences, like you were saying, people start the different theaters start yes-anding each other. And Mick Napier goes from the Annoyance to Second City. So they're all drinking each other's Kool-Aid. And suddenly Chicago is Chicago starts bubbling as a cauldron in unison. And that really takes improv up to the next level because now everyone's working together. And as you know, it didn't start out that way with everyone working together. It started out with a lot of animosity of we're doing it right, they're doing it wrong, which side are you on? Which if you think about it, is really not a way to improvise. But finally, the happy ending is they did improvise.
Right. And I think that whole cross-pollination that finally happened, I think, in the 90s, because I've talked about this on the podcast, Sam, it was almost very territorial, like gangs, you know, you're doing it this way. The Annoyance has a certain style and IO has a certain style and Second City and Comedy Sports. And everybody, when you go into parties, they'd be in separate rooms and stuff like that. But you're right. And I think that was the show. I think Pinata Full of Bees.
Yeah.
Was the one where it took people were starting like it was very IO influenced, and I think that was really one of the beginning of this Renaissance period.
I think that's right. I would probably say the same thing. Absolutely.
And then later you have Citizen Gates, which is directed by Mick Napier, and Tina Fey is in that cast. And what's interesting about that cast is, and a lot of credit has to go to Kelly Leonard, this is the first cast where we're seeing equal men to equal women. And what is Tina Fey? Because Tina Fey doesn't enter that she's not the Tina Fey we know today. What did she learn in that process of doing the show Citizens Gates, which was followed, which was the follow-up to Pinatas?
She learned, I think she learned more as a writer than as an improviser, which maybe fits. And she learned basically to trust her ideas. She learned to speak up. What she learned on stage, I go into that less as in the book because I was more interested in following the Tina that we know, which is basically Tina the writer. And that started when Mick said to her, well, Tina, you know, share this with the group, share this with the group. And at that point, she sort of left. She got out of her shyness a little bit there.
And then, you know, when you talk to the general public, they still really don't know about improv, but they do know about Bill Murray and Stephen Colbert, Farley, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. What do you think it'll take for improv to get the credit it deserves? I mean, your book certainly is, I mean, it's a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, what I had my set sight on was this is an American art form. Art form, which I think has been established, you know, certainly Dell devoted his life to that. I wanted to hammer home the Americanness of it. and tie it to jazz, because that, I think, was easy, is easy to understand the links between improvisation and jazz. What I privately, I mean, between you and me and everyone else who's listening, and some of the other conversations I've had, but I think that it's even more egalitarian than jazz. And I use egalitarian as a criteria for Americanness, because anyone can do this. Whereas with jazz, I don't play an instrument, so I could not get up there and jam. Now, that isn't to say that anyone can be as good as you or any trained improviser, but that if I were to get up there with a great one, I could tread water as long as I was telling the truth. And that would not be the case if I were playing with Miles Davis, for instance. It is only because everyone can improvise, which Viola wrote in the book, and I completely believe, that we can say that this is maybe, possibly, hopefully, in the running for the American art form, not just one of, but maybe even the. So to answer your question, that's one of my grand ambition for this book.
So with all the great press you've been getting on this book, I came across an article that said that made the argument that people with an improv background are even more influential in comedy than stand-ups. What do you think of that?
I don't know. I don't know if that's true. Certainly, if you're looking at Saturday Night Live, it probably is true. But everyone I know, which is not an accurate sample of the world, but everyone I know watches stand-ups on Netflix and stand-up specials. And, you know, Amy Schumer seems to have done pretty nicely first. So I don't know. Do you think that's true?
I don't know. I will say this. You know, when I read that, I'm thinking to myself, I've interviewed a lot of stand-ups, a lot of successful stand-up. And, you know, you'll find out when you do the research that a lot of them have done improv. They have some improv background. So I think you're right. I think it depends, too. Like for Saturday Night Live, I certainly think in a lot of ways, if you look at the history of that show, that improvisers have always had the leg up, except maybe, you know, the Dana Carvey, David Spade in that. But I mean, I think, you know, Groundlings and Second City people and UCP people have always pretty much, you know, had a huge impact on that show.
Well, maybe you could make the argument, and maybe my bias is showing here, that that stand-ups do need some improvisational training if they're going to react to an audience, whereas improvisers, I don't think, do need stand-up training. I don't think they need stand-up training to be an improviser. In fact, you could even say that stand-up training is anathema to pure improvisation.
In your research, improv has expanded across the world. I mean, you had the idea for this book 20 years ago. Is that right?
Well, I started thinking about Second City, you know, because when I was watching SCTV as a kid and thinking, okay, all these people met at Second City. What's that thing called Second City? That's when I started thinking about it. So I wasn't thinking about it in terms of a book. I wasn't even a writer then. But that was when I first started to get obsessed with this thing of what's in the water at Second City. Now, that question later morphed into what's in the water with improvisation, because this book is bigger than Second City. Second City is obviously a major part of the story of improvisation, but what we're talking about is this art form that Second City is only one big piece of.
When you started working on this book, I'm sure you had people, because I was influenced by SCTV too, and I loved that show. Were you surprised? Who were the people that you wanted just as a kid wanted to as you were writing the book that you wanted to talk to because you were big fans of them?
Well, all the SCTV people, you know, that they were my obsession for so many reasons. Not just because I think they are the funniest ensemble of all time. But because those sketches are so layered, well, now I'm riffing on SCTV, but who are the other people I wanted to talk to? I mean, really it was Mike and Elaine, you know, that was
Elaine May.
Yeah.
Why?
And because I think they were the first and the best, and that is a powerful combination. Certainly it goes without saying they were the first, in the sense that these were the first guys to really improvise comedy, not the first improvisers, but the first to really improvise comedy, like I said. And no one knew what that was, and they literally invented it, like we were talking about the kitchen place rules. So I wanted to talk to them, and that's to say nothing of the work that they did subsequent to improvisation, which is also extraordinary. So I was obsessed with them for a lot of reasons. And also, you know, being a Jew and being interested in Jewish humor, Jewish humor is unthinkable without Mike and Elaine, even more so than Woody Allen, I think. I think Woody gets so much credit, deserved, but Mike and Elaine were a step before this in terms of adding the neurosis to this. So that became important to me in wanting to tell this story.
Why do you think, you know, because when I started in the 80s, it was pretty much exclusively a Chicago thing. And now it's not only in this country, but it's all over the world. Why do you think it's become so popular?
I think because it feels good. I think because everybody wants to be free. And this is where it goes from art into a question of wellness, consciousness, and psychology. And this is where it's for everyone. And it's not just about America. It's about how do we live together? How do we help each other? All of these things that those who practice improvisation in their real life take as a kind of religion. And to that end, I really do believe that anyone who does this work and follows the rules is going to live an enhanced life and a better life. And anyone who is an improviser, anyone who's really improvising is going to be a good person. And I think the world has caught on to that. Whether they acknowledge it as that or not, you and I both know that when you're doing this right, you know, nothing comes close. I mean, not even sex, I think, because in my experience, my limited experience in that department, there's still anxiety. But when you're really improvising, there isn't. And of course, you know, in sex too, it's the same thing. But you carry so much baggage into so many different parts of your life, you know, even when you are with your friends, not improvising, just hanging out. A different thing happens when you're on stage or off stage, following the rules of improvisation, that is as close to flying as you can get without leaving the earth. And that's a long-winded way of saying it feels good.
And the other thing you talk about in this book is about you people that have used it in films and television, the improvisation. Because when I was starting out in the 80s, you know, if you try to televise improv or that people would be, it wouldn't translate. Where do you think the purest form of improv to witness the purest form of improv would be?
I haven't found it in a theater in a long time, but that's also because I've been immersed in the past and I haven't gone out to see a lot of improv recently. But the best improv that I've seen in the last handful of years happened in my friend's kitchen. And I was hanging out with actually a couple of three improvisers from Toronto, some from Chicago, Stephen Campman, Bob Dolman, who was a writer on SCTV, and Dick Blasucci, who performed in Chicago. And I was hanging out with these guys, and they did a 3-hour long marathon improvisation. That is one of those things where it was like, you know, like Dell, you would say, this is fireworks. It's there for a second and it's gone. There's just no way to explain what it was like to hang out with these people in the kitchen and watch them riff with each other. in part because not just were they so funny and free, but what happens is when you do this, you fall in love. That's what happens. And I could see these guys falling in love with each other and me with them. And the good feeling in the room was so beautiful. I haven't felt that in a theater in a long time. But again, that's not bad news because we all have kitchens and we all have friends. So why go out?
Why do you think it worked? If I was to throw you a curveball here, why do you think it worked in the kitchen with those three guys?
Because they knew what yes and meant, and they told the truth, and they weren't afraid to ride out a moment of awkwardness. So they could sit in a strange thing, and out of that strange thing could come a laugh or a feeling. If you allow for that strange, uncomfortable thing, you can't lose. Because either way, even if it's not funny, I mean, if it's funny, it's great. And if it's not funny, it's emotionally true. So again, improv, follow the rules, have patience. You know, this is what I love about slow improv, Del's idea of slow improv. I really think that one of the big fuck ups is rushing, you know, speed. Because there you can miss the emotional moment. But if you're slow, you can't miss the emotional moment. And then you really cannot lose. So I think these guys had that.
So we always end the podcast. This has just been such a fun conversation with you, Sam. I always ask, and this might not even be a fair question, but I think you probably could answer this. What one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today? You've talked to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase.
No. It's a great question. I think my answer is an answer that a lot of people wouldn't like because it puts you in your head. But I think it's go to therapy. You know? Or if you can't afford therapy or don't want to pay for therapy, read about the unconscious.
Why is that? Why would you say go to therapy? Why would you say read about the unconscious?
Because it opens you up to worlds of possibility that are inside you that you may not believe exist. And even if you do believe they exist, you may not have accessed them yourself. And when improv is really happening, it's only because the improvisers have tapped into this stuff. So get to know your unconscious is what I'm saying. And then, of course, the downside to that is get out of your head. You know, you can get in your head if you know your head. So get to know your unconscious and then forget you have one. I guess my advice.
Another question came to me because I'm obsessed and I really did this. I started this podcast to find out why people are so successful and I'm not. But here's the question is, what did you find for all the great improvisers? What were the qualities that were similar with all of them? Like if you could boil it down to two or three things, like they had this or they had that, they had drive or they had this or they had that.
Well, this story is different than many other stories of success because there is more luck here. And that's what makes the story hard to tell. What were those guys doing in Toronto? There's no reason why these incredibly brilliant, funny people should be in Toronto when there's no comedy scene in Toronto. It doesn't make sense.
You're
it
talking
was an
about
accident.
TV, or you're talking about Second City?
Second City.
Okay.
Second City.
Okay.
Which I think with this story of improvisation, a luck had a lot to do with it. In life, what makes a good improviser? Or are you talking what makes a successful person in any field?
I want both. I want both of them. I want the answer to both of them.
I think the answer is the opposite.
Okay.
I think to be success in any field but improvisation, you have to be obsessed with what you're doing. But I think obsession is undermines good improvisation. You have to be willing to let go in improvisation. And obsession is holding on. So I think those two things work against each other. How to be a great improviser? You have to let go. But does that mean you're going to be a success in the world? I don't know. I mean, a lot of the purest improvisers, in fact, guys like Sills, guys like Viola Spolin, guys like Paul Sand, guys like Joe Flaherty, guys like Dell, their talents are in opposition to obsession and perfection and all perfectionism and all these things that you need to make a big commercial success. Elaine May is a perfect example of that. It's one of the reasons she kept bombing out as a filmmaker, not artistically, but financially, because the life of somebody who is constantly experimental is not going to be the life of somebody who says, like Mike, well, how do we sell this?
And I almost look at, in the book, Paul Sills' life and certainly Dell's life, that they almost sacrificed a career, because they both could have had much bigger careers if they wanted. Dell lived in Chicago. He had spent some time in L.A. And Paul had many opportunities to direct in New York, didn't he?
Yep. Turned it down a lot. Yep.
They were artists underneath, and they sacrificed for this art form, and we're kind of reaping those benefits today.
Well, yeah, yes, and you bring up the right. I mean, those guys, they knew that the minute money touched this stuff, it killed it, and that's one of the stories that goes through my book, and I think Elaine is a beautiful exception to that because she tried to walk that line. Because the minute you're dealing with money, you now have to be perfect, and being perfect is it kills the pressure to be perfect kills improvisation. So I don't think you can have it both ways. I mean, Bill Murray has, he certainly has, but God, how many Bill Murrays are there out there?
But there's almost in your book, there's almost a sadness to Paul Sills at the end, where he's sitting and having dinner with Mike Nichols.
Yeah,
I mean, Mike Nichols has won, you know, all these Oscars, and he's worked with all these famous people, and he's made a ton of money. And here's Paul Sills still trying to do experimental theater.
That is the very scene I was thinking of when you asked that question. And in that scene, there are these two guys, great friends, who are looking over the table at the other saying, I wish I could be you. And Mike knew that for all of his success, he knew to a certain extent that he wasn't doing the really important work that he used to be doing. And that's why, one of the reasons why he started a school with Paul Sills and George Morrison later in his life, because he knew that this is really where the real work was. And can you have that and Saturday Night Live level success? I don't think, not in the same moment. I don't think you can have that. I don't think you have the freedom to fail when the whole world is watching.
It's sad. It's really, really sad to think about that, you know, because it's just sad to me, because I've been part of great groups and done great improv shows and, you know, seen great improv shows. And it's like, it's sad that they can't get more, notoriety. Yes.
No, I don't. Well, I mean, I think there are exceptions. So I would urge you and me, because I'm feeling sad the way you're feeling sad, not to remember the moments like the Elaine May, you know, the moments like Saturday Night Live episode one, when no one really knew what they were going to do. And those moments can exist, but they are as rare as falling in love. You know, I mean, we don't blow our brains out every day because there's that tiny possibility that we're going to fall in love today or tomorrow. Tiny. And maybe it's the same fraction of possibility that we're going to see improv succeed on the giant mega blockbuster scale. So don't get too depressed, Jimmy.
But you know what? There's also hope to this, because if I would have known this going into improv back when I was 20, you know, 18 years old, and thinking it's all about fame, I think that would have helped me know, like, okay, this in a lot of ways, this cannot be a corrupted art form.
No, it can't. And as you now know, improv, a true ensemble, can't sustain a star. So to do this work right, you literally cannot act as you're famous, nor can your ensemble treat you as if you are famous. But you didn't know that going into it. And also, fame, as you now know, is like an addiction like any other. If what you want is fame, well, you're never going to have enough, because you can always have more. But what you can't, you know, but you know that now. You didn't know that then.
And I bet you this, because I have this experience with my friends that have gone on. I bet you people wanted to talk to you in this book because they look back at those days in improv when they were struggling in Second City or the Groundlings or UCB or whatever, because they look at those days fondly.
Yes. They look at those days fondly because there were no stakes. All they wanted to do was learn improvisation and have fun and fuck around and experiment and discover this stuff. It was a absolute beautiful time. It was uncorrupted. Even though you were fighting with Second City and they were fighting with you, that's only because you were so full of passion and dreams that you felt so strongly about this stuff. And then, you know, I see it with my friends. It's not just improv, really, what you're talking about. It's getting older. It's, well, now I have to pay the bills because I've got kids. And so this thing called art may take a back seat. And you don't have kids. You don't have a wife or a spouse. You don't have all these things when you're young and crazy. But I think it's beautiful, Jimmy, that you had it even for a second, because some people, they don't have it at all.
Great. Sam, you've helped me so much healing my past. I really appreciate it. Pick up this book. It's called Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. And it is a great, I couldn't put this book down. And
thank you.
It's such a fascinating read. You got to pick it up. If you're in improv or you're a fan of comedy, it is a great book. And you're a great writer, Sam. Thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
Thank you, Jimmy, so much.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Sam Wasson. His book is Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. Pick it up today. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. I'd also like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want to know more about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, intensives, and workshops called The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, when you're on my website, sign up for my Improv Nerd newsletter. Each week, I will send you a new blog that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Also, like us on our Facebook page. Improv Nerd has a Facebook page, and like us because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd, and our YouTube channel, Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. Support our Patreon campaign, which is Patreon/Improv Nerd. We are lucky to be on Feral Audio. They are a wonderful podcast collective. We are just one of many hilarious and interesting and innovative podcast. Did I get enough adjectives out there? I think I did. So check out their podcast at feralaudio.com. And a big thank you to you for listening, not only this episode, but for the rest of the year, which will be 5 days, so I'm wrong there, for all the years that you've listened. I'm correcting myself. I was wrong. I want to thank you for all the years that you listened to this podcast. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And as always, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins. One day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my